And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Stephen Cohen with us. Of course, we'll get your calls in just a second. Stephen, you said something earlier about what are we going to leave behind with our children with this new kind of new Cold War. And that's my concern, too. What are we going to give them?
Well, the last Cold War, which lasted 45 years, from the late 40s to about 89, 90, or 91, not only created a world of anxiety and the fear of the possibility of nuclear holocaust, but, and this depends on your domestic politics, it impacted the way we live at home. Conservatives will remember it made the American government bigger because it was kind of a government perpetually preparing for war. And we spent more money on war-like things. People on the left will remember that it deprived the social programs they like of funding. So we're going to relive that, and it's going to exacerbate the debates we have in Congress now between Democrats and Republicans about how we use federal funds, because some of those funds will have to go to the new military buildup. But I worry more about the way we see the world, because we lived all these years in an educational system and a system of popular culture that polarized the world between good and evil, and turned out things were more complicated. Remember, back in the 1990s, less than 20 years ago, Clinton told us that Russia was now our permanent good friend and partner. And remember that after we were attacked on 9/11, Putin was the first foreign leader to call President Bush and say, "George, we're with you. What can we do to help?"
And he
did help a lot in Afghanistan. Putin gave the United States Army in Afghanistan so much help that it saved American lives. And for a brief period after that, it looked like we were going to be friends and partners now with Putin's Russia. And that was barely 10 years ago, and it's gone. And so the world's more complicated than, you know, this black and white. The world's gray, I guess, too often. But we're going to go back to a black and white world, and we're going to misunderstand things. We're going to make mistakes. We and Russia, too, are going to be drawn into foreign adventures because we're going to see our interests threatened everywhere in the world. I mean, I guess it's the so-called peace dividend that we thought we had won, or some people thought. I didn't think so 25 years ago when the Soviet Union ended. That we're not going to have.
Stephen, where does
our children aren't going to have, I should say.
Where does China fit in with all this?
Well, you know, this is really interesting because of the policy of the American government, and here I quote President Obama, is to isolate Russia through these sanctions and this political condemnation. But it's impossible to isolate Russia. First of all, Russia is, what, the fifth or sixth largest economy
in
the world.
It's a huge energy producer. Huge.
It produces, if you take natural gas and oil together, it is the number one energy exporter in the world, bigger than Saudi Arabia. The number one thirst for Russian energy is China. And on that basis, China and Russia have forged an ever closer political, economic, military alliance. It will now grow. But note a few things. That when we ask the world to condemn what Putin did by taking over, taking back, annexing, however you see it, Crimea, that part of Ukraine, a couple weeks ago, the United States was not supported at the UN by China, India, most of Latin America, Iran, or even Israel. That's interesting. It means you can't isolate Russia. It just means that you can push Russia further east, so to speak. And when it goes east, it will go to and with China.
Mm-hmm.
And
seems
that's
biblical.
That's not good for Russia, by the way. Not the Russia I'd like to see. I've lived there so many years, I think about what I hope to see in Russia. And it's certainly not good for the West. It's only good for China.
It's great for China.
It's great for China.
Let's take some calls here. We'll go to Michael in Virginia Beach, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Michael. Get us going here.
Thank you so much, and God bless you both for a tremendous and timely interview. Professor Cohen, in his book, The Keys of This Blood, the late Malachi Martin listed several things in chapter 33, I think it was, that Mikhail Gorbachev did, and that Reagan and the Reagan administration did, that resulted in the perestroika that you praised and so many others have praised as having been the end of the Cold War at that time. Could you list specific things? I'll tell you what He said, well, first of all, Gorbachev removed 400 medium-sized missiles from Soviet Asia. He withdrew 200,000 troops from the Far East. And then on our side, we reduced troops in North Korea and...
South Korea.
Pardon me?
South Korea,
I'm sorry. We reduced our troop numbers in South Korea. All of these things were positive, specific things that created a more trustful atmosphere. Could you suggest several things that President Obama could do to reduce this crisis, to create a more trustful atmosphere?
That's interesting. I don't know that book, and obviously something I need to look at because I'm trying to evaluate what Gorbachev and Reagan did, and that author mentioned some things I haven't thought of. I'd add to that that Gorbachev led to the complete withdrawal of Russian troops from Eastern Europe. I mean, that's the big legacy. Gorbachev also made possible, because without him it would not have been possible, the reunification of Germany. Also forgotten, and particularly by Obama, who claimed that he wanted to abolish nuclear weapons a few years ago. He never mentioned, and I resent this, and I think all the people who still respect Reagan's legacy resent it, and I know Gorbachev resents it. Obama never mentioned that the only time in history a whole category of nuclear weapons has been abolished was when Reagan and Gorbachev abolished so-called intermediate-range nuclear weapons. Those were the ones that could fly from Germany to Russia and from Russia to Germany. They were abolished. Now they're going to come back as a result of this crisis. I think it depends on how specific George wants to get, that there is an agenda of negotiations that Obama could act on. And I think Putin would respond. I could be wrong, but I think he would. But generally speaking, I put it like this. What Reagan did is he looked carefully at Gorbachev. He said he's a rational man, and he shares with me a hatred of nuclear weapons. That was what bound them together, interestingly enough. I'm going to meet him halfway and see if he meets me halfway. And so he did. And I was working then for CBS News, and I went to Geneva when Reagan and Gorbachev first met. We all thought it would go badly. Reagan was known as the arch cold warrior. He was 20 years older than Gorbachev or thereabouts. He was from a completely different place, and they hit it off. And from there, they went on to make history. So my answer is, Obama should try, even if he fails, but he should try to figure a way that if there's two sides to this Ukrainian story, as I believe there are, he should try to meet Putin halfway. But to simply say Putin is the source of all the problems, he began the crisis, he's the aggressor, only he can make concessions, that's a non-starter. So, you know, the greatness of Reagan, the greatness of any political leader, is to rise above when the circumstances arise, that leader's former self. Reagan rose above being the historic cold warrior and became the man. He wrote this in his diary, by the way, January 1989, when he left office. We, meaning he and Gorbachev, have ended the Cold War. Now, you and I may think, looking back, and that's not fair, that he was wrong. But that's what he thought he had achieved, and that was Reagan's greatness. He rose above himself because he saw something new that could lead to something virtuous. That's what Obama, this dreamer, he self-professed dreamer, needs to dream at this moment.
He better do it pretty darn fast, Stephen.
Tomorrow would be good.
Yeah. At worst, what could happen with this situation, in your opinion?
You know, I have always not liked, let's put it inelegantly, people who go on the air, claim to be experts, and give you worst possible outcomes. But I guess we're at the moment where we have to think about the worst so we do the best to avoid it. The worst is hot war with Russia. In the scenario I mentioned to you at the beginning of our broadcast, that Ukraine descends into civil war, it's on the abyss. Russia feels it has to intervene to save ethnic Russians in the east. NATO responds by entering Ukraine on the west across the Polish border, and we're at the Cuban Missile Crisis, and nobody knows what happens next. By the way, I mean, just to give you an example of what I think is bad advice Obama is getting, and I don't have the slightest idea who's advising him about Russia. We knew who advised previous presidents. We don't know who advises Obama. Sometimes I think he advises only himself.
Yeah.
But he decided to send 150 or 175 American paratroopers to five or six East European countries along Russia's frontiers. decided this a few days ago, right. And they're there now.
Poland being one of the countries.
Poland, Romania, the three Baltic republics is five. I'm not sure about Bulgaria, but let's say five. Now, I would have said to him, Mr. President, I understand the symbolism, but it's dangerous because what if a few Americans die there? Maybe they die by at the hand of a provocative act, like these snipers running.
Yeah, a sniper
Ukraine.
Does. That's right.
Then there's going to be a clamor here in this country. We got to go to war with Russia. You don't want any more tripwires. So let it be Italian paratroopers or German paratroopers or Czech paratroopers.
Or no paratroopers.
Well, whatever. But don't put any American bodies in harm's way in a situation where something you don't want to happen that will reduce your space for decision-making will happen. So I think that's the kind of thing that we shouldn't be doing.
I think you're right. You know, we're forcing his hand.
Well, he ain't going to listen to us.
Nope. Let's go next to Vista, California. Al's with us on the wild card line. Al, thank you. Go ahead.
Hi. I think in the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, we missed a great opportunity to the Warsaw Pact was dissolved. I think we should have dissolved NATO at that point and had a joint European security agency with Russia. And I also think we should have put more economic resources into Russia to help them develop in a proper way. I think, though, we may have another opportunity now to try to have a security conference with Russia and all the nations of Europe to maybe have a new European agency that replaces NATO. What do you think about that? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, I think you're right. I lived in Russia during part of the 90s, and I saw by American behavior in Russia that what you just suggested was not happening. We were treating Russia the way we treated Japan and Germany after World War II, as a defeated supplicant state that was to do what we said at home and abroad. And I could see the backlash building, even among my friends who were pro-American and democratic. They were saying, what are you doing? What are you doing? You can't treat us like this. As for NATO, here's the problem. NATO is a vast bureaucracy with headquarters in Brussels. It employs probably hundreds of thousands of civilian bureaucrats. This is their job. They want a mission. They want their salaries. They want their promotions. I'm not sure whose security they think they represent, but I do know the United States pays about 60% of the NATO's bill, which is supposed to defend all of Western Europe. So NATO was looking for a mission, and now it's got one. I mean, after all, Afghanistan couldn't be the mission. We're supposed to be withdrawing. Now, Russia came forward in 2007, 2008, and said, if you will begin to abolish NATO, we would like to propose to you, just what your caller just suggested, a trans-European, including Russia, security treaty that would replace NATO. And let's talk about it. And we would not talk about it. Now, whether that was because we, the United States, were short-sighted, whether because we were out to get Russia and saw this as a Russian trick, or because the impetus of the NATO bureaucracy was so great that it wasn't possible. But whatever the explanation, push came to shove, and here we are, NATO and Russian forces, without Eastern Europe to separate us, way off in Berlin, coming closer to eyeball to eyeball.
What would it take?
By the way, George, here's an interesting point. 60% of American supplies to NATO and American troops in Afghanistan today, where we're still fighting, go through Russia, either on the ground or through Russian air corridors. What if Putin shuts that down?
That's right.
Now, that raises two questions. How are we going to fight on in Afghanistan until we get out, if we get out? But if we get out, how are we going to get out? We're supposed to get out the way we came in, through and over Russia. So we can't go through Pakistan anymore. It's too dangerous.
By the way, why are we still there?
I don't think
we went in there in October of 2001. We went in there. We're coming up on 13 years.
I don't know. Well, how long were the Russians bogged down there? They went in 1979.
They were in there for about 10 years.
And they went out in, well, he withdrew in 89. So 79, 89, 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah, well, we like to exceed the Russians. We've done it in lack of wisdom.
They're still in Iraq, too.
I mean, you wonder what we think. I mean, no foreign army has ever prevailed in Afghanistan going back centuries. It's a special type of arrogance that both the Soviet Union and Cold War America had that thought we could do what no other could. And yet the Cold War was over, and we've tried again.
But
to be fair to Obama, he didn't He didn't begin this war.
No, he didn't, but he kept it going.
He kept it going.
And out of sight, out of mind, Stephen. I mean, most of the media, they don't handle the story anymore. They're on the plane crash, and the guy who owns the Clippers, and they've forgotten about.
Well, it's getting worse than that. I mean, if I'm right, and I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so. I've been doing this, I don't know, 40 years.
See, you do it also with a news perspective, and that's important.
Well, I try. I mean, I was in the media for a while I was in the university. So, and my wife's the editor of a weekly magazine, and I read the papers and watch TV. I'm a consumer. But here's the thing. I mean, you mentioned we don't cover the story in Afghanistan or even Iraq, where there's a new war breaking out. But we stopped covering the Ukrainian crisis because the networks got obsessed with the missing aircraft.
That's right.
And it's become a kind of Saturday Night Live sick joke. You remember the old Franco is still dead?
Yeah.
The airplane's still missing. And now we've got this you know, elderly, sexually challenged, anxious about black men guy out in California. It's all over the news waves now. And, you know, I said to a friend the other day, if Putin wants to take over the whole of Eastern Europe under the American media radar, he's caught a break.
Now is the time.
Possible. Wait a minute. It's also possible. I put this out there for your more conspiratorial minded listeners that Putin has the plane.
Well, that's very possible.
To distract what he's doing.
I'm not going to deny that. Let's go to Evan and Fenton. We've got a quick time for you, Evan, before the break. Go ahead.
Okay, Professor has a colleague, Francis Boyle, the University of Illinois Law School, international law professor, author of Destroying Libya and World Order. He's the first that I heard, George, where he chronicled the fact that Victoria Nuland of the U.S. State Department and Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, they had a private dialogue going that was apparently intercepted by the Russians or whomever, wherein they're gleefully celebrating their $5 billion coup d'etat in the Ukraine. It left nothing to the imagination.
Gosh.
Okay, and prior to that, George, to answer your question about Afghanistan, people like Craig B. Hewlett, Catherine Austin Fitz, authors Robert LeBivier, Dollars for Terror, Robert Dreyfus, Devil's Game, and John Cooley of the Christian Science Monitor, Unholy Wars. It's all about heroin, opium, poppy.
Oh, yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I threw that out rhetorically. Why are we still there? But, I mean, you're right. I mean, the poppy seed production is higher now than it ever was when the Taliban stopped it. We're going to come back more with Stephen F. Cohen. Final segment and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, this is our final segment, your phone calls with Stephen Cohen as we talk about Russia and the situation in Ukraine, by the way. Hey, are you a member yet of the Beyond Belief team? You can be. Watch our television program, 10 days free. Watch all the videos, by the way, not just our show. You get them all. Simply go to this website, sign up for it, beyondbelief.com, www.beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Stephen, by the way, a friend of mine used to work for ABC News in New York. His name was Stephen Cohen, too. So for a split second, I thought, it's Steve.
There seem to be a lot of us. There's also the hedge fund investor who's about to go to, well, who knows why.
That's right.
And,
it's not
there's
you.
There's a lot of us. There's also a bail bond lawyer in New York named Steve Cohen. And sometimes in the middle of the night, if I leave my phone on, I get a call. Somebody needs to be bailed out. I say you got the wrong
stuff. Wrong guy.
Yep.
So what's it going to take to get Putin to somewhat back down a little bit?
On March 17th, the Russians made proposals for the settlement of a crisis. It called for de-escalation on both sides in Ukraine, emptying the buildings, disarming the militia, and the rest. It called for a new Ukrainian constitution that would be federal, so that the regions would have more rights, including electing their own governors, who are now appointed by Kiev. It called for an agreement that Ukraine would never be a member of NATO, and in return, Russia offered to help bail out Ukraine from its terrible economic crisis. It seemed that on April 17th, I think, in Geneva, The United States signed on to that. Now, however, that agreement of in Geneva is falling apart on the American charge that Putin is not de-escalating, but escalating the crisis. And I think everybody knows that's what we're saying now. Kerry said it today. Putin said it. Obama said it today. But what is Putin saying? He's saying, well, look, your government in Kiev just sent about 15,000 military men toward East Ukraine, military units. That's escalation. Call those people back. De-escalate. And then we'll do what we can to de-escalate. Now comes this second problem. I do not know, and I've been studying Russia for 40 years, I do not know the extent to which Russia is responsible for the unrest in eastern Ukraine. Much of it is clearly indigenous. It's been going on 20 years. Sure. It's reacting to Ukraine. But Russia could do something to chill some people out there. For example, if tomorrow Putin went on Ukrainian and Russian television, Ukrainians tend to watch both, and said, all right, we need peace in Ukraine. We have to avoid a civil war. I ask everybody in eastern Ukraine who is occupying buildings to give up the buildings, go home.
Go home.
Because in return, Ukraine has agreed to a new constitution which will empower your regions in some way, and you'll get a chance to vote on it in a referendum. If he said that tomorrow, some people would go home, but my guess is the tough guys would not.
Right.
And therefore, both Obama and Putin, I keep coming back to this because ultimately I believe in leadership. They have to rise above whatever they think of each other. They have to rise above this situation, and they have to do what Reagan and Gorbachev did beginning in 1985. They have to see something in the other guy's story, embrace that part of the story, ask the other guy to see the legitimacy of your side of the story, embrace that, and go from there. That's not happening, and it's the only way out. I can't think of another, can you?
No, I really can't. And, you know, Putin, former KGB, once KGB, always KGB.
Yeah, but what does that mean? I mean, it's interesting. I knew a lot of ex and still active KGB, not a lot. That's not right. I knew three or four in the 90s. One, weirdly enough, was writing his doctoral dissertation about me. And since after 1991, when the Soviet Union ended, the KGB library had been pilfered, stolen. People had taken the material and stolen and sold them. He had no books he needed, and he asked me if I could get him some of these American books for his dissertation, and would I give him an interview so that his doctoral supervisor would say, that's great, you interviewed Cohen. And I did, and we began to talk. And, you know, there are all kinds of guys in the KGB, just like there are all kinds of people in the CIA. Many of my students went to work for the CIA, and they're really scholars. They sit in the agency reading the same material I have, but they have also classified material that I don't have. And they think, and they write reports, and they hope they'll reach the president. And they're very smart, and they're rarely wrong, and they're not ideological, they're analytical. What kind of KGB agent was Putin? Well, he's definitely a KGB loyalist. He has a corporate loyalty to the KGB. There's no question about it. But he wasn't a great KGB agent. Most of them rise to general by the age of 40. He was still a colonel when he retired. I don't know why. I guess he didn't impress his superiors. His career was made politically by the Yeltsin people, who embraced him in St. Petersburg, Leningrad, and promoted him. So, you know, to say it's not, I mean, George Bush was the head of the CIA. Now, that's not the same thing because he was not a career CIA officer, so far as we know.
He was a political.
That's right. But nonetheless, he was associated for some time with the CIA, but we didn't say, oh, everything he does is shaped by having been a CIA. I mean, some of the people in the KGB are better than other Russians because they're less ideological, they're smarter, they're more analytical, and above all, they know more. One thing about a good intelligence officer, and if the person isn't like this, get rid of him in any service or her. If they're ideological to the extent that they ignore or distort facts, they're not serving the security of your nation. So I'm not sure it tells us a whole lot. I mean, would it be better if he'd been a lifetime poet? I don't know. Or a professor like me? I don't know. It doesn't tell us enough, I'm afraid. It's an easy way. You know, Henry Kissinger wrote in the Washington Post, and to a certain extent, he borrowed from me because I've been writing this for years. Demonizing Putin is not a policy. it's an alibi for not having a policy. That's pretty smart when you stop to think about it. We can demonize him, call him every name we want. And I don't recall, but maybe you do, but I don't recall us ever vilifying personally latter-day Soviet leaders the way we've villainized Putin, who's not Soviet. I mean, Nixon and Brezhnev really liked each other. They got on. They went hunting together. They had a similar mentality, resentment of intellectuals.
Well, Putin's a strange guy, Stephen.
Well,
I mean, he jumps on his horse with his shirt off and, you know, sends it out to the media. He's just weird.
I don't know. I mean, look, is it really? Stop and think. It's PR. Would you agree with that?
Of course.
All right. Remember who he succeeded. He succeeded a terribly ill man who had to have open heart surgery. American doctors, Dr. Barclay or Bakley, from whatever, was flown in to save Yeltsin's life while he was president. He was an alcoholic. He couldn't attend most meetings. Russia knew this. He had to resign. Part of Putin's popularity from the beginning was his virility and his health. And in fact, he was welcomed in Washington in 2000 and 2001 as a sober, healthy Yeltsin. Now Washington changed his mind. But part of the message that Putin constantly sends to Russia is, I'm not Yeltsin. And you do that, and he's pretty well-toned in terms for a 60-year-old guy or a 55-year-old guy when that picture was taken. He's pretty well-toned through the chest and the arms. He's been pumping a long time.
He's been pumping.
He was sending the message, I'm still not Yeltsin. And I get what he's doing when he flies jets and he goes deep-sea diving and he does all the, and jumps out of planes or whatever he does.
Goes fishing with his boots up
right.
to him.
But don't our presidents, I mean, Reagan, you remember people were worried Reagan was too old.
Yeah.
He'd take pictures of himself chopping wood on his ranch.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crude PR, but we invented PR, and we recognize it.
Let's go back to the phones. We go to Stephen in Eugene, Oregon. Welcome to the program, Stephen. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, George. Hi, Stephen. Hey, your books are brilliant, and I really want to applaud you wholeheartedly for bringing some of this information out about Russia and Putin to dispel some of the propaganda and outright lies that are being told to the American people. I mean, it just sickening. And I say that because I've been to Russia 5 times. My wife is Russian of 15 years, and I read the Russian news. So I get a different perspective than most Americans. And the interesting thing was, I was born in 51, so I went through the whole Cold War thing. And my first trip to Russia, the first thing I had to do was unwind all the propaganda that had been instilled in me as a child about Russia and just realize it's people. It's a wonderful country with huge culture, arts, and just so much to offer. And it just makes me sick the way the U.S. is going after Russia and Putin over something that we instigated in the Ukraine. And people need to realize that, you know, we're being fed a bunch of lies and untruths. I get more facts from Russian news that I can assimilate the truth from than anything that the mainstream media puts out. But my question to you is, how much of this, of the U.S. going after Russia and Putin currently, is because of the situation with the American petrodollar and the ability of Russia to threaten that to a major, major problem?
Well, that's a good possibility. Does it have anything to do with oil money, Stephen?
It's got something to do with it, but I don't know how much. I mean, the limits of my knowledge, I'm always aware of them. I used to ask my students at Princeton. I had a course that involved making decisions. How did we get into Vietnam? Because in the history books, there are 3 or 4 reasons, one of them being economic, one being ideological, one being the Cold War. I think one thing we learn from history is that every major policy or event, it can't be explained by one factor. It's usually several. And then you decide which was the most important. People think today, I don't know if it's true, that we got into the Iraq War because we were after the oil. A lot of oil there. People think that our animosity toward Iran has to do with Iran's oil. It's certainly a factor. There's no question about it. In the case of Russia, though, and this policy toward Putin, you've got this overhanging, heavy legacy of the Cold War. I mean, my generation, and I'm older than your caller who just called in, my generation just grew up with a way of thinking about Russia. And just because the Soviet Union ended doesn't mean we stopped thinking kind of instinctively that way. And I think that's true of our policy elite. And I can tell you, I was educated at Indiana University. I got my PhD at Columbia. I taught 30 years at Princeton, now at NYU. that all these universities that have schools of international affairs or teach about them are still riddled with this Cold War thinking. We pass it on to our young would-be bureaucrats. So I don't know. Is it attitude? Is it the fact that America's never... I mean, there's a different attitude toward Russia in Germany, because Germany and Russia have shared the same history, for better and for worse.
Better and worse.
Yeah. Right. Germans think of Russians as kind of wayward cousins. We just need to have a good talk with them, and we'll sort it out. We don't think of Russia as related to us at all, but then we're not part of European history, except when we venture there occasionally, and then we come home. One thing your caller said about the shock of recognition, of suddenly having an experience that shakes your bookish knowledge. By the way, I'm terribly impressed by how many of your listeners
are
book readers.
They are amazing.
They are amazing.
Best
I don't know
listeners.
Anybody who's read. I mean, they all are reading all the time. Well, how do they have time to listen to you? I mean, it's amazing.
Well, I'm honest. They're listening to me in bed. Or they're working somewhere.
But he mentioned going to the Soviet Union for the first time, or Russia, and being kind of shocked by how the realities collided with what he had read and heard. I had two formative experiences. One, I mentioned before, was growing up in completely segregated Kentucky. And that experience made me think about change and about alternatives. I was always impressed by the fact that the presidents of the Confederacy and the Union during our Civil War were both from Kentucky, Lincoln and Jefferson Davis. So how did Kentucky produce there are different roads from a different place. And why do you take them and why don't you? And then the question of how things change. I brought that to my study of Russia. The second experience I had is when I began to live in Russia for the first time, 2 or 3 months a year, during the Soviet period, in the late 70s and 80s. The reality of everyday life, I lived in Moscow, months and months and months, the reality was so different from what I thought of myself as a really perceptive, knowledgeable guy, had gleaned from books and newspapers, that I had to rethink much of what I thought. So personal experience, in the end, is essential, which takes me back to our political elite. It's not our people who get us in these crazy. This is my way of, it's not the people. None of us want this. But we've created an elite that seems to have a hard time dealing with reality at home.
It's what Eisenhower warned about, the industrial military complex.
But don't you think that it's even bigger than that, that even people who aren't in that complex, but who live in Washington year after year after year and get promoted and move from job to job, that becomes their reality?
Oh, yeah.
And they're not bad people. They just stunt and abort or they...
But some of them are bad people, Stephen. I think some of them are darn right evil. I really do.
Well, I'm slow to judge on that level because I'm not all that proud of everything I've done, but I take your point. But if they're evil doers, but do they do evil for evil reasons, or are they just ignorant? That's what I ask myself.
I think some of them are psychopaths. I really do.
Well, democracy's not supposed to. We the people have permitted these people.
Yeah, that's true. John,
to exercise power, and then we failed.
Let's go to John in Hugo, Oklahoma, get a few more calls in. Go ahead, John.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Cohen, I read a book back in the 90s called The Perestroika Deception.
Yeah.
And this was a book written by a Russian defector, an operative, intelligence. And what he was trying to convince the American government of was the fact that perestroika was a deception created by the Russian elites. To cover up for the fact that they lost the Cold War, we bankrupted them, they couldn't continue the war anymore for economic reasons, and also their brand of communism had failed, and they needed to create this deception of perestroika in order to reinvent themselves more along democratic lines. Have you read that book, and what do you think about
that? I remember it, and I think, I mean, I would just put it in different language. I don't know why you need the word deception. Gorbachev came to the conclusion, we don't know exactly when, but we think probably, certainly by 1983, he became leader in 1985, but my guess it began because he'd been working as essentially a governor in the provinces. Then he came to Moscow as a minister. I think this began in the 1970s, and it was encouraged by his wife, Raisa, who was a very smart woman, that the Soviet system had achieved a lot at least to the extent that it defeated Nazi Germany in the East, but was now failing. And a full-scale reformation was needed. Now, Gorbachev had the idea, it was Putin's idea, that he needed to carry out something like Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, which was kind of an attempt to reform American capitalism during the Depression. So he set out to do that, acknowledging that the failures of the Soviet Union might be terminal. That meant markets, and it meant democracy. But why we call that a deception? Because by 1988, 89, he was saying that to the Soviet people. And by the way, he was talking about it with Reagan, and he was talking about it with the first President Bush. I wouldn't say advised, but the first President Bush asked me to meet with him three times in 1989, once with his entire cabinet, not I alone, but with others. Mm-hmm. And I remember Bush saying, you know, one of the things that impresses me about Gorbachev is how candid he is about their problems and what he's trying to achieve, and I think we should help him. Do you agree? Because he was being told, Bush was, by his own party, that you shouldn't help Gorbachev.
Got about 30 seconds left.
Well, that's the story. I mean, that's people understood that at the time. Now, Gorbachev failed in his dream to carry out a democratic reformation and save the Soviet Union. But his intentions, I think, were clear.
Stephen, can we tap into your expertise during this Ukrainian situation and keep in touch?
Anytime. I'm a nocturnal person, and I'm happy to have people to talk to, and I like your callers.
Okay. Stephen Cohen, our special guest. We shall be back in a moment with Brad Willis, a former NBC correspondent who's alive to tell us why.